Okay, this is a joint work with Harrison Quick, who's one of my PhD students. He's in fact going to graduate next year and will be in the job market. And Brad Carling, who's my colleague in Minnesota. So I thought that this might be an appropriate talk for this particular session because it has a little more public health and it also relates to a data set from California. So the point about space and time, and Monse already gave a nice overview of a fairly important and relevant problem in our field. But if I had to say this in one line, I would say that it's the importance of where and when in statistics. And, you know, if you are a physicist and you believe in relativity, then you will say, well, we all live in space and time. Obviously we do. But for statisticians, where and when becomes important, not always, but in certain cases. So when do we have to take account of the where and the when? And space-time modeling, if I really want to put this in a simplistic setting, would actually, broadly speaking, fall into one of four settings: continuous space, discrete time. So this means that, you know, you actually think that the outcome that you're observing that actually exists pretty much everywhere in continuum over space. Could be temperature, for instance, right? I mean, wherever you go, their temperature exists. You may not have observed it, but at least it exists. Sometimes it's aggregated over time, though. You don't maybe monitor temperature continuously over time, but you have a summary over time, like maybe daily maximum, maybe monthly maximum, maybe weekly maximum or something. So that's like discrete time, in the sense you're discretizing the observation. That's what's available to you. Then you could have continuous space and continuous time. So that's like, you know, when you're monitoring, say, something like directional wind data, all right? So you're actually having a continuous time model here where you're basically seeing how the wind, the direction of the wind is changing over space, continuous over space, but continuously over time. The third one is discrete space and discrete time. This is very popular in public health, and this is where you actually look at not continuous space in the sense that you actually look at regions, like counties or census tracts or zip codes, and you basically aggregate the data over those regions, and that's the referencing you get. It's very popular in public health because in public health we do not actually have access to individual level data simply because of HIPAA and other privacy issues. So you aggregate it over a region, and that's all you can get. And discrete time, simply because of convenience, if not for anything else, that again you actually aggregated over maybe a month or a week or some resolution. Okay, but here's a fourth category that actually recently, in very recent times, has started garnering some attention, which is discrete space and continuous time. And if you pause for a second and try to imagine what type of data set would fall into this fourth category, for those of us who have been working with public health data, it may not be that immediate. But the situation is such that, you know, we are having a wealth of data, and this discretization of time is getting finer and finer and finer. And so, for instance, nowadays it's possible to look at daily hospital visits or you know, daily counts of certain public health outcomes. And when the data is though presented to you, it may be presented as a monthly aggregate. But the client, the epidemiologist or the public health administrator, may come to you and say, you know what, I can give you the data maybe aggregated at a monthly level, but I want you to interpolate my outcome on the 26th of January or something like that, all right? So these types of problems have cropped up. And more than the mechanics of the data, it is the inferential questions that sort of force us to think a little bit out of the box and try to say, okay, how are we going to model this fourth type of situation? So the first three, there's a lot of literature in there. The fourth one, not so much. So that's what I'm going to talk about a little bit. So here's a situation where this could come in. Take a look at asthma hospitalization rates in California. This data comes from Sacramento, it's the whole state of California, but I think the public health data office is essentially in Sacramento where this data came to us from, and it's county level data. There are 58 counties in California, if I'm not mistaken. I think so. At least that's what my map in R tells me. So, in any case, it's too late now. If it's not 58, then don't worry, pretend it's 58, and I'll show you the map. It's aggregated monthly from 1991 to 2008, so there are 216 time points, okay? So just to make sure that we know the complexity of the problem in terms of the size of the data, literally speaking, you can think about this as 216 times 58 data points. So that's a fairly large number of data points, okay? And it's often converted to rates, so something like, say, per 1,000 residents. What's the hospitalization rate per 1,000 residents? And the question is, can I actually look at a hospitalization rate at a daily level? And this is important for hospital administrators because it'll help them to plan better. So this serves two purposes. One is, as I said, from an purely administrative point of view, data collected over, aggregated over, you know, like a month or over a week is usually less noisy because it's sort of averaged and aggregated, you know, than data at a daily level. And by noisy, I don't necessarily mean the sophisticated or the complicated concept of noise in statistical models, but just errors, you know, in entering data. If I ask you to enter data every day, every hour, that's kind of more cumbersome and problematic to maintain those without error than, you know, having it on a daily basis. You collect and just place one entry in your Excel spreadsheet for every month. But then the question is, the hospital administrator may say, look, I need actually a daily rate. I need you to tell me how this is varying on a daily basis. So this is an interesting problem. The basic idea for, if you ask a statistician, a mathematical statistician or a modeler, he's basically going to say, all right, so here's the problem. We need to operate at a resolution much finer than where the observations have come from. And at the same time, we need to understand the spatial association for these temporal trends. So can we treat this problem as one of discrete space and discrete time? Okay, let's ask this question to us. Do I really need something else, or can I just place this into a situation where it's discrete space, discrete time? Many of these dynamic models, Kalman filter models, so on, they all fall in that category. Do I really need something special? Well, I'll answer this question, but let's. So here's what happens typically. You know, here's a map. You can see the 58 counties, and the red zones are where the counts are higher, and the blues are the good regions. So that's the spatial mapping of the data for you. This is at an aggregated at an yearly level. All right. So this is the total number of hospitalizations every year. And then if you go to the monthly level, this is the month. So that's 12 times whatever number of years I had in the previous slide. And then you can go to the weekly level, and then you can go to the monthly level, and you see that there's just an enormous amount of maps that you suddenly are faced with to analyze. And there will be some covariates and predictors because there is this recent interest in the impact of climate change and climate variables on asthma hospitalizations. Obviously, we will be remiss if we miss some of these covariates, so we have to take care of these as well. So before I start, you know, getting into you know, too much of technical details, let me just give you a brief idea. If I were to model this, typically, I would probably say something like this. Okay, yi sub it could be a rate. Let's suppose I convert it into a rate that comes from the ith region at time t. There would be a trend that captures log scale variation. Then there would be a z sub it, which would be kind of like an unknown function. The more formal way of looking at that is a region-specific stochastic process. So the stochastic process, or the function's argument, is time here, not space, because space is discrete. Okay, it is indexed by I. It depends on I, but as a function, it's a function of t. Now, if you're wondering what a stochastic process essentially is, think about it this way. If you have an unknown variable, you usually use a distribution to model that, right? If you have an unknown function, what do you use to model? So stochastic process is a probabilistic tool to literally do that, all right? And then you have some noise, and it looks fairly like it, similar to a standard linear model of the fundamental law of statistics, mean plus error, except that I have just the error split up into two components there. And we have to keep in mind that, okay, whatever we do, if these are functions, then they will be similar across I. So here's the problem. So there's a complex spatial dependency and time dependency here. What we are trying to model is something like this. You know, if you look at the first row, let's say this is the these two rows, they correspond to two regions, and you will have a time-varying phenomenon that you're observing. So z1, t1 is a function observed at maybe time t1 from region 1, then time t2 at region 1, then time t3 at region 1. And then similarly, you have z2t from region 2. And the point is that, well, okay, if I go across these arrows here on the top row, they are associations between these functions across time within the first location. If I go around the second row, then it's the association across time for the second region. And then you have these things. If you look at these vertical rows, then they're these vertical arrows, then they're the association at one time point between two neighboring regions. And then you have these crosses, which is basically the covariance between your observations of two neighboring regions, but observed at two different time points, neighboring time points. Okay, so there's quite a bit of correlation that could exist. And if you want to capture these, you basically need to come up with a valid model, so to speak, that will actually capture all this. The key point here is that what is my objective with regard to space? With regard to space, it's just smoothing, literally. Okay, if you have neighbors, the rates are going to be more similar to each other than if they're farther apart. What is my inferential objective with regard to time? It's interpolation. All right, it's interpolation. So there are two different objectives here: one with regard to space, one with regard to time. Okay. Without getting into too much of technical detail, if I want to have a discrete space continuous time model, then this is one way to actually proceed with it. You take the map, you construct its adjacency matrix, which basically has a diagonal, has zeros along the diagonal, but that's sort of by convention. That means I'm not a neighbor of myself, counterintuitive as it is. This is a customary way to define the neighborhood matrix. And then you have a one or maybe some other scalar. I take one here if you are a neighbor. So that means the ith element is a one if I and j are neighbors. Now, at each time point, what you can do is you can actually do a kind of a probabilistic version of what is known as k nearest neighbors. So in other words, I say that the probability of zit conditional on everything else depends only upon a weighted average of the neighbors. And that weighted average is given by wij divided by wi plus, wi plus being the total number of neighbors for region I. So you scale it by that. It has certain technical advantages, which I'm not going to get into the details of. And then you have the variance, which is sigma squared divided by the number of neighbors. There are two issues that you might be wondering. All right, I define these conditional distributions this way. Am I guaranteed to get a valid joint distribution? In general, the answer is no. In general, if you give me conditional distributions, it's not necessary that they all can pile up into a vector of with a valid joint probability distribution. But if they do, they must be what is called a Markov random field. And this is an example of such a thing. And this particular model that I've written is a special case that actually guarantees you that you actually are going to have a valid joint distribution across the i's. All right? There's that alpha. That's sort of a bothersome parameter, because if you keep that alpha as equal to 1, which means you kind of don't keep it in the model, then the dispersion matrix that you get out of this multivariate normal is actually singular. So you get what is called a singular normal distribution, which resides in a sort of a soft space, not in the whole space. And you can work with that, but it's easier to actually just keep that alpha in there and let that alpha be a parameter between 0 and 1, which ensures that the joint distribution that you get will be proper. So here's what happens. You then get this guy, that once you collect the ZITs into a vector, you get this sigma squared times D minus alpha W whole inverse. For any network model, nowadays, you know, these sorts of models are used not only in spatial statistics, but in graphical models where you have neighbor relations. And that D minus alpha W is a very famous matrix. It's called the Laplacian of the map or the Laplacian of the graph, whatever you call it. And it essentially is the D minus alpha W is, in fact, the precision. It's the precision. One of the major advantages of this is, even though that inverse appears there for that matrix, in the computation, you can use a little bit of linear algebra to actually completely avoid that inverse. So that's why, in terms of space, we really don't have a very huge complexity, computational complexity, in fitting these models. Okay, so the MRF, this is a time-dependent MRF, but I have not told you how to actually model temporal dependence. So the now here comes the question that I raised a couple of slides back. What if you were in a discrete space, discrete time situation? Well, you know what? You would just go back here. You would take a space-time neighborhood, and you would just do a Markov-random field. You would just do a Markov-random field. And you would say, hey, what's the big deal? Yeah, so I have a space-time model. Well, yes, but let's take a second and try to understand one major property of the Markov-random field. Now, the roots of this result are they lie in measure theory in what is called Kolmogorov's consistency theorem, but I'm not going to talk anything about that. But let me just show you one important feature of any Markov-random field model, and it is like this. Well, actually, I shouldn't say any Markov-random field, but except for certain pathological cases, most Markov-random fields suffer from this problem. So consider a Markov-random field that you constructed for n regions. You give me California's 58 counties, I give you a Markov-random field model. I get a joint distribution. Now you say, you know what, I'm interested in actually bringing in a couple of neighbors from Oregon, all right? Or maybe from Mexico, for that matter. So you give me those other regions, I form the new neighborhood matrix, the new neighborhood graph, I construct extend my Markov-random field to incorporate them. So that's P2. Okay, the first one was P1, with only the 58 counties of California. Now with Oregon, I have P2. Okay, now suppose the why not comes from the new region, the count or the rate or so on. I integrate out the why not. You know what? I do not get back the original model for California anymore. So in other words, technically what we say is that this is not a stochastic process model. And if this is not a stochastic process model, the problem is that I cannot interpolate at any arbitrary time point. You have to give me every time point where I want to model, and then I have to do that. So that's why discrete space, discrete time breaks down. Okay, there is a reason for doing mathematics and all this mathematical madness. If the existing technologies worked, I would not have been giving this talk. But it doesn't. And this is the reason it doesn't. Okay, I'm going to very quickly go through this. Basically, what we therefore do is we bring in a process. And you can do all sorts of stochastic processes here. It doesn't have to be the Gaussian process, but the Gaussian process is probably one of the most versatile processes, especially if you have a fairly smooth signal, which is continuous. It doesn't have to be differentiable, but suppose it's continuous. And then you basically look at the multivariate Gaussian process, like a vector process, and get the covariance, and you actually model the what is called the cross-covariance matrix, which is the covariance between ZT and ZU. ZT and ZU are collected over the entire space, but at time point T and U. And then you can form a joint dispersion matrix. So the problem boils down to modeling this valid cross-covariance. Okay, very quickly, here's a very simple specification. You take the KZTU, that's the cross-covariance matrix, as sigma squared times a correlation function in time multiplied by D minus alpha W whole inverse. And this gives you what is called a separable structure. RC corresponds to space, D minus alpha W inverse corresponds to time, and so on. A lot of criticisms for this model exist. I'm not going to get into that. This is one example. Okay, it doesn't have to do anything with the overall modeling structure that I have. And then you actually can build a hierarchical model, I'm not getting into the details of that, but the key point is that it's very standard. You know, even though it may look daunting, these models are really standard. You can use a Gibbs sampler to update this model with a couple of Metropolis steps, and they have pretty good convergence behavior, and they're fast. They're fast because, number one, I have just 58 counties, and number two, because I don't need matrix inversions. No matrix inversions with respect to space, because this guy, D minus alpha W inverse, actually the D minus alpha W is what comes out in the computations, not the inverse. Okay, one key point is temporal gradients. So our client said that not only do we want to actually know the time trend, but we want to know the rate of change of over time at any particular point. Why is that important? In epidemiology, one of the major tasks of doing spatial modeling is to basically say, all right, you give me some covariates, I look at the residual map, and I look for lurking covariates. Well, you know what? If you have two covariates that are sort of changing their values very drastically over a local region, you don't really identify those missing covariates from residual maps. So a better way to do that is to actually calculate the residual process's gradient, see the gradient map, and then try to say, okay, if that's a gradient, that may be caused by a sharp change in a covariate that is changing sharply between these two locations. That helps in terms of those covariates. A simple simulation study can reveal that. But the key point of looking at a gradient is like your definition you have in high school calculus our undergraduate calculus, except that we are now looking at derivatives of random variables, and there's a technology to do that. It's basically called an L2 norm, so the limit just basically goes in a particular way to zero. But it's pretty much like a finite difference minus that, and that thing goes to zero. And then you say that that Vi prime T naught that you see there, that's the derivative of the process. So one of the cool things is that as soon as I actually model the correlation function, which I showed you before, I can actually determine the smoothness of my process and whether the derivative exists or not. Here's one example of a nice little function that admits first-order derivatives, but no more. So I'm not over-smoothing, but I need derivatives, so therefore I need to make sure that my process is differentiable once, but not twice. And that's one example. It's analytically available to you, and you can actually work out a lot of mathematics. Once you fit the model, getting the inference on the gradients is just by sample. You don't need to do work with finite numerical differences and worry about that h in the denominator becoming smaller and smaller and leading to explosion in the numerics. You just do a conditional normal sampling, and you get the marginal posterior using what is called composition sampling. Very standard Bayesian predictive analysis. A simulation example to show what happens. You have a true signal, and you have an interpolated signal. Left-hand side is a Gaussian process. The Gaussian process is an interpolator. That's a very well-known result. Does it interpolate the gradients? Theoretically, no. But if you have observed it at a fairly fine resolution, it does a pretty good job. That's the right-hand signal. I did not assume that I knew the signal here. So the signal was generated from a sine curve. I just fit a Gaussian process WT curve. I didn't assume any sine in that thing. The Gaussian process interpolates, so it captures the sinusoidal thing, and then the derivative is the cosine signal on the right. It captures that as well. So the reason why we need spatial and space-time is available here. If you like DIC or if you like your other types of model comparison metrics, you see a big drop in aerially referenced Gaussian processes. You know, there's a drop of 7,000 in the DIC from a regular car model for this data. A random intercept and slope, it's about a 4,000 deficit. So anyway, it's absolutely clear that you need to account for space and time in these sorts of things to make a reasonable inference. You can get predictors. Some of these you can adjust for, like seasonal effects in these sorts of data. And so you're more interested in the residual. You can map the temporal gradients, average them, over the map. So these are temporal gradients. You can see where the gradients, which counties have high gradients, which counties have low gradients. And this is a map that we provide the epidemiologists who can actually look for covariates, bring them in, and then go further. Temporal trends here for Los Angeles and San Francisco. There are some interesting stories here, which I'm not going to get into. But a very quick thing here, if you look at LA County, you look at for the entire data set, it's like sort of like this is your temporal gradient. The gray shade is the credible interval around that. You can zoom in from 95 to 2001 and try to see the finer features of the gradient interpolation, where the rates are high and low. And in 1995, for instance, there's a sharp drop here. You can zoom in further and try to see why there's a drop and how the observations are around that and what the numerical gradient is and how well the process is doing. You can do some sensitivity analysis on these things. And then finally, let's not forget the regression coefficients. They obviously tell you about the seasonality's impact in the data and whether it's diminishing over time. To cut the long story short, for this particular data set, we found that asthma hospitalization, in fact, is going down over time. But that's not necessarily a good thing because that could be correlated with global warming in some sense because winters are becoming more like summers and so on. I'll just stop here because I'm way over time. And I think Amy has been kind enough to let me go on, but thank you.
Go ahead.
So, an alternative to the Markov random field type structure, you could have a Gaussian process, but use a hyper inverse Wisher using the adjacency graph. Have you thought of doing that?
Oh, yeah. You have a Gaussian, that will become interesting if you have multivariate outcomes, frankly speaking. Otherwise, I think for univariate outcomes, meaning that, say, for instance, you're looking at not just asthma hospitalization, but another correlated space-time outcome, then I think it certainly has potential. Adrian Dobra has been doing quite a bit of work in that. For univariate cases, I think it'll be overkill if you really try to do that, because in the couple, what does it do for you? It essentially will add another dimension of correlation in terms of between the outcomes now. You see, which I don't have to worry about here.
You're giving more flexibility.
The thing about the flexibility is, yeah, I mean, you're right. It will give you more flexibility. It gives you another dimension of correlation. I haven't, to be honest, done it here, but I very much doubt it's going to make a big impact in the substantive inference for this particular situation. But absolutely, if you have more complex dependencies, that's the way to go. Thank you.